We welcome artists who experiment, who innovate, who show us ourselves and our world. From SDPB, it's Friday, November 15th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, a Sioux Falls-based band returns with a new album. The self-titled Pale Norse and the Cinderblock Sharks dropped on the first of the month. David Saul returns to the program. That's a bit later in the hour. The music director and the principal cellist of the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra preview their Saturday concert. The program features music both familiar and new. We'll talk world premieres and classic Copland. Plus, an exhibition opens today that centers plants and weeds in the human world. Susan Hegestad takes us into We Are All Weeds. That's coming up after the news. We are broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Tonight, an artist reception at the Ida Dalrymple Gallery invites viewers to step back and remember that the world doesn't revolve around us. Sometimes it revolves around our flora. We Are All Weeds, by visual artist and teacher Susan Hegestad, opens tonight and runs through Thursday, December 12th. The artist stopped by our Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls with a preview.
We Are All Weeds came as a title in the last, handful of months as I was winding down the preparation for this exhibit, a lot of which has plant imagery in it. And there is a piece immediately in the entryway to the gallery titled We Are All Weeds. It features a handful of textiles that I've been embroidering over the past year and a half that are visual diagrams from the South Dakota Book of Weeds. It's like, it's pretty common. A lot of 4-H'ers probably know it. You can get it at your Clay County Extension. I've always had this book around. I really love
it.
And for me, one, it's the practical. I spend a lot of time in the garden. I spend a lot of time outdoors walking, and I love finding out about plants. There are so many native plants and quote-unquote weeds that we are surrounded with, that we ignore, that we overlook, that are in fact medicinals. They're dye plants, edible. And for me, it's just also very evocative because the world we live in can be very limiting and often ignores or excludes certain things, certain people. They belong or they don't belong. And I hope that it calls some of those questions for people to think about what we, things that we think are not useful, or people, like we, if we're an immigrant, we're a kind of weed, aren't we?
Not native
to this place.
Tell me about the art-making practice. You have all this technical skill, and you have things that are found objects, and the making and the mixed media. And then yet there's also a narrative, maybe not a narrative, but themes taking shape. Do you think and then make? Do you make and then things emerge?
That's a great question. I've actually been talking about that quite a bit this morning with students at Augustana, which was lovely. I do a little bit of both. I would say that for the most part, I'm a very intuitive artist, though. I play with materials. I'm drawn to materials. I, especially in the last couple of years, I love natural materials. I'm always just looking at grass with this weird eye of like, oh, what would that texture be good for? And I pick up tiny pine cones and fill my pockets with them. But I generally play with things until they tell me what they want to be. Once in a blue moon, something emerges in my mind, and then I try to make it. And there is one piece in particular in the show that evolved like that. And it was really hard for me. It took almost 4 years to finish that piece.
Really?
Yeah.
How did you trust the process of 4 years? And by that, I mean, maybe you didn't trust the process.
I didn't always. Lori. I had the image in my mind and I sketched it. And I was telling the students this, you know, that may be how you work. And that's fantastic. I think a lot of sculptors I know do that. I jumped in with how I thought I needed to make that piece, in this case, a found chair, and I started filling it with plaster. And I very quickly hit a wall that I realized, wow, this piece is heavy, so heavy that I may not be able to move it to continue to work on it.
Yeah.
And is that practical for, you know, getting it around and showing
sure.
it? I set it aside and almost threw it away twice because I thought, what am I doing? Why right. do I keep hanging on to this? I was patient,
yeah.
and eventually a solution came to me, and then I'm very proud of myself for allowing myself to finish it, because I'm very distractible in the studio.
Yeah. So I have so many questions now that have just like blossomed in my my mind, in the sense of like, what is your relationship with failure? And then what is your relationship with follow through?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I know a lot of artists, I'm not alone in this, that you have to come to grips with failure.
Mm-hmm.
I think an essential part of being a creative of any sort is to redefine failure for yourself, to become comfortable with failure, to even embrace it and celebrate it sometimes, because solutions come in the most unexpected ways at times. And if I stay in my rigid original vision, I often miss out. And I have had, at my age and stage of life, I have learned enough times that it will come if I'm patient.
Yeah.
I'm not a perfectionist. I'm also not a completist.
Okay.
Which is, with the earlier piece I was mentioning, it is easy for me now oftentimes to abandon things. It might be partly ADHD, but it's also because I know that if it needs to be made, it will come back around.
It will come back around.
It'll come back around.
So talk about installing, or, you know, getting, because part of the exhibition has an installation feel to it. And I don't know if people always know what that means versus just hanging something on the wall.
Sure.
When we walk into the gallery, what are we looking for?
Well, I try to approach this exhibition with a somewhat open mind. And in that, I mean that Lindsay Twa, the director of the gallery and professor at Augustana, discussed whether it would be an installation, how I felt about that, because my last major exhibition was very much an installation piece and required me to do sort of every step.
Yeah.
I thought, why don't I let go of the reins a little bit and not be as concerned about that? But there were elements for me that I still couldn't let go of. And so visitors will see when they come in, the first piece that is titled after the title of the show, We Are All Weeds, is more of an installation, because, one, it expands into the viewer's space. It is multiple components that, you know, they go beyond. It's not just a single piece on the wall. It sort of exists in space, and it's not actually finished.
Okay.
It is a piece that is still evolving for me, that I envision at some point will be a whole forest that people enter into. Now that I have started it, I'm like, oh, I'm so excited to do that. But not to tease anyone, that it is the beginning of something that I think will be more fully an installation elsewhere. But the rest of the show are standalone pieces that have maybe some hints at installation, especially because many of them are furniture.
And
we live in spaces with furniture. So I do think that feeling comes across for people.
We live in spaces with, so two things here. One is just a relationship with an artist where you get to watch their work evolve, and sometimes even the same piece evolves.
Oh, yeah.
So let's not let that moment pass by, that when you support your local artists, especially, you have the opportunity to go back
get
in and say,
a little sneak peek.
Yeah. And I remember when this, you know, began like this, like a musician hearing their next album.
Exactly.
And their
I
never next album.
About that
and their next
analogy.
Album.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then this idea of furniture, fabric, embroidery, these are domestic things in the sense of of where we live and how we live and the very mm-hmm. ordinariness of our lives, but reimagined right. artistically. What captivates you about ordinary things?
Oh, yeah, it's multifold. Well, first I want to say thank you for that analogy with watching musicians evolve yeah. or things, because I am, I would be remiss if I didn't say I'm very heavily influenced by poets and music yeah. And literature and all of these things. And you know, none of us exist in a vacuum. But the domestic sphere for me, there are layers, but I really have become very fixed on the aspects of our world that we deem feminine and inferior. And there is a femininity that we put on the domestic sphere mm-hmm. because traditionally it's been the, right. the woman's sphere, as well as the landscape. We tend to deem that as a feminine thing as well. And so I'm conflating them mm-hmm. a bit. And then there are also elements of the figure, of the body. And most of the time it is my body because that's what's practical. And so in terms of practicality, that's the other reason, is because I am not an artist that has had the stereotypical like career where I have a tenure track job, nor do I have gallery representation, right? So yeah. my work does not pay my bills. And so I do it the best way I can, which is mm-hmm. in between other things, whenever I have time, sort of as disciplined as I can with the materials that are easily obtained.
Yeah.
Because that's what I can afford. It's like, you know, cast off furniture from the thrift store and I repurpose it. Sometimes there are things that have been gifted to me.
Sure.
You know?
What a great tradition we have in the Midwest of that.
Oh.
As well.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
I have rug hookers in my family. And mm-hmm. the fabric, the wool that you take from mm-hmm. the clothes that people have worn and you cut and you tear
yes.
and you put them into beautiful patterns and walk on them on the floor. And a braided rug that was passed down. Same thing, rags,
right,
braided,
right.
more than 100 years old.
So there are objects that, right, that get passed around. And then yeah. there's also the techniques, like you
yeah.
said. Embroidery
yeah.
is represented, beading, a lot of stitching. And for me, those are all things that have been passed down, sometimes over generations. It is often feminine. I don't want to exclude anyone in that because
yeah.
lots of people practice these handicrafts, but that's my experience, right?
Yeah. So my great-grandfather was a house painter.
Love it.
And a painter.
So yeah.
many people around here have these stories mm-hmm. of, but yet we don't think of ourselves as artists.
Oh, no.
You're the artist, I'm not.
I want people
yeah.
to also hopefully see that. I
yeah.
certainly impress that upon the students that you are, especially in the contemporary world, you are welcome to use whatever you want. And
yeah.
why does it have to be special and precious? And it doesn't have to be. And in fact, I'm even pushing myself toward the like ephemeral, like especially
yeah.
with my interest in landscape, why do I have to make things that are going to be cast in metal? Like, it's okay if I make things out of grass and that it falls apart and goes away eventually. Why do I have to be concerned about its archivalness? If it speaks to something, I think it's still compelling. And if it falls apart, I'll make another one out of next year's grass. You know what I mean?
So,
that
so
to me is very appealing, right?
We fall apart too, don't we?
Exactly.
It's a very human thing.
Exactly.
We're all going to decompose here together,
yes.
along with the art.
I'm glad that you yeah. touched on that, because I've been trying to say that. I didn't want to touch on that so
yeah.
much with the students this morning, but I want to bring that up during my discussion in the reception, is that I do think that's an intrinsic part of what I am thinking about lately and concerned about with this work, is that we are so afraid of death
yeah.
often that we cannot live right now in this life, and we don't see how we're connected to the world around us.
That's artist Susan Hegestad. Their exhibition, We Are All Weeds, opens tonight at Augustana University's Art Gallery. You can see it in Sioux Falls through December 12th. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The next South Dakota Symphony Orchestra concert is tomorrow. That's Saturday, November 16th, 7:30 local time at the Washington Pavilion in Sioux Falls. Now, the concert features new and familiar faces playing new and familiar pieces. The SDSO's principal cellist, Robert Erhard, will play Antonín Dvořák's Cello Concerto in B minor. The program also includes a world premiere and a side-by-side performance by the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra and the South Dakota Symphony Youth Orchestra. All the pieces explore themes of patriotism, immigration, and homeland. Maestro Delta David Geyer is the music director of the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra. Robert Erhard is orchestra's principal cellist.
The first piece on the program is The Moldau by Smetana, not a household name, but a very popular piece. But he was a contemporary and a fellow countryman of Dvořák. Okay. So we're kind of bookending with these Czech composers. And then in between, we have a premiere of a new song cycle by Paul Moravec. The first poem of the first song is by a woman named Anna Vacek. It's about immigrating to America. The whole song cycle is about immigration. And she landed in Ellis Island, I believe, in 1911. And I'm pretty sure she came from Bohemia, or what's today the Czech Republic. And it's within a few years of when Dvořák lived in the U.S. in the 1890s. So that's kind of an interesting tie-in.
Yeah. A little bit more about Paul Moravec, because he's been on the show before. This song cycle is a lot about America and coming to America and embracing a new country. Tell me a little bit more about him as a composer, an award-winning composer, and about this song cycle.
Paul was the first Pulitzer Prize-winning composer we had here 20 years ago, my first season with the South Dakota Symphony. He's been here four times before. Initially, it was the cello concerto, and then it was a suite of orchestral music from his opera, The Shining. Yeah. And that recording just came out, and it's been nominated for Grammy. It's a wonderful opera. So, yeah, no, we're big believers in Paul.
Yeah. And now, Dvořák, the cello concerto. We'll bring Robbie in here in just a minute, but first tell us, big picture, you mentioned Dvořák coming to America. This is written during that time?
Well, yeah, most of it was written in New York City. I can let Robbie fill in those details, okay. But he finished it up, I think, after he'd gone back.
That's right. Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yep.
Tell us a little bit about the concerto. The history of it, what you know about the composer. Help set the stage, and then we'll talk a little bit about it musically.
Absolutely. So Dvořák wrote the concerto, most of the concerto, except for the very end of the last movement in his final year in New York City after he spent a year in Spillville, Iowa, actually not too far away from here.
Mm-hmm. A big Czech community
A big Czech community
yeah.
there.
Right.
Yeah. Yep.
Mm-hmm. No, so he came over here. There was a woman, Jeanette Thurber, who brought him to New York to help us establish an American voice, mm-hmm. you know, an American style of composition, because he was the quintessential Czech composer. He used Czech folk material, and he was famous for saying, in the music of the African-American and the Native American, you have everything that you need to generate a truly American art form. And he demonstrated that. You could hear some of that in the concerto, Robbie, you think? I mean, there's Czech folk music and American folk music. They have some similarities, right?
Absolutely.
Melodically. And
absolutely. Yep. Yeah. And I think, in particular, I'm thinking about the second theme in the first movement, which kind of really sounds like an American folk song. Mm-hmm. When I hear it and when I play it. And at least that's the way I would want it to come across.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Right,
so melodic.
It's poignant.
And, yeah.
Very poignant.
What's the relationship between what you're doing, what the orchestra is doing? Help me understand how the back and forth is. Are you always out front? Is it sometimes that, you know, you're behind the orchestra?
Right. So this is famously sometimes referred to as Dvořák's 10th symphony because of the prominent role of the orchestra in the piece as a whole. So you'll hear the cello very frequently in dialogue with a solo wind instrument, for example, or sometimes doing a flashy accompaniment to a melody that's happening somewhere else. So really, there's a lot of interaction and weaving in and out of the texture between the cello and the orchestra.
It's easy to think that there's notes on a page and that you are performing them and you have to be rigidly there at the notes on the page. But in the concert, as an audience member, it certainly seems like it's a very organic, although structured and prepared thing. There's also a breath to it in some ways that leaves room for the unexpected.
Absolutely, yeah, and I love the way you put that. I think music needs to breathe, and for me, that's just keeping my ears open. And so every time that we'll do it as an orchestra, whether it's in rehearsal or in performance, it's going to be a little different,
yeah.
Right? And that's because we're all paying attention a little differently, noticing something a little bit more, a little different. A different player decides to bring something else out this time that they didn't do the last time, or we do leave room in this orchestra in particular for a certain level of spontaneity and artistic expression on stage. So that is actually one aspect that I'm really looking forward to, is there's something about the piece that will come to life when there's 70 other musicians on stage,
yeah,
really breathing life into every phrase.
And an audience.
Mm-hmm. And an audience.
Who is also part of this dialogue in some ways.
Absolutely.
Maestro, help me. You know, this is what you have to, you're playing this whole instrument, you know, the orchestra, mm-hmm, us, the audience, everything is under your control in some ways. Tell me.
That's a nice thought.
Tell me a little bit about how you prepare, but then also do leave room for the moment.
Well, I work with really wonderful musicians. Yeah. This is the thing. It's like doing this Dvorak concerto with all of the interplay that Robbie just described, it's going to be so magical because, well, I mean, there's nothing better than playing with your colleagues in a solo role. I mean, everybody's like yeah, totally cheering you on. And you've amassed a pretty decent fan club already here in Sioux Falls. People yeah, really like you a lot. And so you're going to have about as much support as you could ever have in a soloist role. So,
yeah.
And the way Dvorak writes, sometimes you have concertos where the soloist is in danger of being covered up by the orchestra and, you know, that sort of thing. But Dvorak is so masterful in the way that he writes this concerto that it would be able to give that freedom to the orchestra to really play this piece well, and to, you know, give room for that spontaneity. Dvorak's sometime mentor, but certainly his model, was Johannes Brahms. And Brahms, like Robbie just mentioned about Dvorak, when he wrote his concertos, he was accused of writing symphonies with piano obbligato. You know,
help
like,
people understand what you just said.
Well, obbligato is like something like filigree on top of the substance. Like he's really writing a symphony, and oh, by the way, there's a piano.
Okay.
You know, and
so
there's some of that with this concerto because, like, I mean, how many minutes introduction would the orchestra play before you even play a note in this concerto?
It's about four.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And every major theme in the first movement has already been played by the orchestra before I get to play it.
Yeah.
So
how's that fair?
I think it's great.
Yeah. Well, and it's really dramatic. It's
it
big.
Is.
It's not just like, you know, Minji kind of setting up the soloist. It's big.
When I'm in the audience, what should I listen for? Robbie, I want to start with you. From you as a soloist, what should I listen for?
Listen for all of the beautiful lyrical melodies. And just there's just so many of them. The piece is just chock full of them. Just enjoy it, because I think it really is one of the most accessible pieces of classical music out there, without sacrificing any of the artistic depth and complexity. So it's going to give an opportunity to, it really explores the full range of human emotion in this, yeah, in this piece. So,
and we're all feeling the full range of human emotion right now as well. What should I listen for, Meister Geyer?
Well, that interplay that Robbie was talking about. I mean, listen for how he plays with Will Cedaniel, our principal flute, or Jeff Paul, our principal oboe. And they have a dialogue, you know, like you can really we can really easily notice that.
We're so lucky that, you know, you mentioned the Robbie fan club. There's a Jeff Paul fan club, and we want you to stay a really long time. We're a little bit selfish in South Dakota. Like, Dusit Kim has ruined it for everybody else. Like, our expectation is, you know, 25 years and counting. And we want you to always be here with us.
Well, we've actually talked about, like, making baseball cards with our players, something like that. Trading cards of some sort.
Cards of some kind. All right.
Yeah.
Anything else that we should be listening for this in this concert?
Well, I should just mention again that the first piece is side by side with the youth orchestra.
Yeah.
And this is, well, you know from Jane having done this, that this is hugely impactful because every single student in our top youth orchestra, we have four of them, but the top youth orchestra will be seated on a stand with a professional SDSL player and playing this wonderful music together. This is the Smetana, the Moldau, which is the river which runs through the Czech Republic. But this, usually when the kids come out and they graduate and they move on, and they'll point to these side-by-side concerts as their high point in their musical life to this point.
The South Dakota Symphony Orchestra's performance is tomorrow, Saturday, November 16th, 7:30 p.m. Central Time. That is in the Great Hall of the Washington Pavilion, downtown Sioux Falls. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. A little bit there from the new album Pale Norse and the Cinderblock Sharks. The Sioux Falls-based band dropped a new album at the beginning of the month. Now, their founder, David Saul, has been with us before, and he joined me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio earlier this week to break down the band's unique sound. We'll start with a look back at how the Pale Norse got his start.
In Highmore, South Dakota, a friend of mine, Nick Wasajizek, and myself, we'd kind of always talked about maybe learning how to play guitar. And there was a guy who had moved into town, small town, but who my mother knew that we wanted to learn how to play guitar. So we ended up taking some lessons from him. And he would just say, here's one chord. And he'd say, simple stuff. That was his whole thing. We got a couple chords, and then we were just off and rolling, just wrote and just played for fun there. And when I got to Sioux Falls, that's when I really started meeting up with the musicians, some of them that I still play with today, when I was about 17. So that had been 98 or so that I really started.
So that's a good time for the Sioux Falls music scene. And you're part of that emergence, really.
Yeah. And I know the house scenes were really big, but from our point of view, we didn't know a lot of those people that ran in those crews. So we actually started just cold calling bars. Yeah, they'd let you play. You know, as long as you'd come in, promise not to do anything, they'd let you play. So, I mean, you know, places like Phil's Pub and Mulligan's, lots of crazy stuff. We still had a lot of good time, but
yeah. What were audiences like then?
It was win 'em over. So we most of these places would have built-in crowds that would be there. Phil's Pub was a little more of a scene thing. You know, that's when I started getting to know some of the other bands, but the other places you would just go in. We played all originals, but we kind of just figured if we could win these guys over, we could play. I think that first night we played down there, it was 3 hours, and it was just all this weird material that we had done. And, you know, it was a softball just gotten out.
Yeah.
So they were all coming back to their bar to hang out. And at first, you know, not too happy with us, but we'd, you know, mix some stuff in, trying some stuff and do some different stuff. And eventually they were having fun with it.
What were you called then?
That would have been a band called Neil. And you can still find some of that out there. We kind of did it under a different name of Botfang, as you can find it if you want to find it. Yeah. And then we just had the Neil demos because it was just all the recordings that we did. I always planned on making an album, but yeah, we kind of made one eventually, but you know, back then you're super oh, I'm no good. You know, nothing is good. This is all, this isn't good. He didn't quite understand what we wanted in this recording, you know?
Okay.
So then you just toss it aside and then you listen to it, you know, 20 years later and you're like, yeah, that wasn't so bad.
Yeah.
You know, that was actually pretty good.
I listen to your stuff now and I think it has a feel of urgency and rawness and newness still. So I'm wondering if you weren't just able to keep that in some ways.
Yeah. Well, the thing that happened a lot with, especially like the Phil's Pub, you know, running into people through these different places as you're meeting them, everybody always says, you know, oh, it'd be so cool for us to do something sometime.
Yeah.
So that's what this whole group was about. So it really took me to go back from being like a three-piece or a four-piece, and I'm in complete control, but I can get these amazing people together. And then I have to almost kind of lay back a little bit and just find something. So it's still new to me. I mean, the fact that we jam, you know, like we get together and jam. If you'd have told myself that, you know, in 97, 98, I'd have been so disappointed in myself, you know, because I wasn't about the jam bands and stuff like that. I wanted, you know, this certain sound, you know, that I had in my head. And now I get to work with all these people I've always wanted to work with around here. And it's been fun.
All right. So where does Cinderblock Sharks come from? Dale Norris and the Cinderblock Sharks.
Cinderblock Sharks was actually our new keyboard player, synth player, Dustin. He went to school where a group of guys, they called themselves the Cinderblock Sharks. And when we were going through names, because each album that we're doing, since maybe somebody will be added in to the next album that wasn't there, somebody else has to move on and then somebody different will come in, it was always, we'll keep changing the name of the group.
Yeah.
So this album, we kind of were throwing some different stuff out there and everybody just liked that name. So we kind of stole it from his friend group from college and threw it on as the background group. So
yeah. And who's all on the album? You mentioned some of these folks that you've always wanted to play with.
Well, Dustin Scheidler plays with the keys and all that. We got Jason Bannock playing drums, and then Carl Kaiser, which he is guitar, and he also writes pretty much everybody but Jason Bannock and Dustin Scheidler have written one of these songs.
Okay.
But we kind of write together, but I don't want to discount that. Carl right now, he's a lead singer for Off Contact. He's got his own side stuff that he's got going on all the time. Very artistic guy. And he also travels with bands as a sound guy professionally as well. Sean Egan of the Donnybrook Brawlers is his main band, playing, writing, plays bass. Myself,
Jeff Zuger.
Yeah, because he moved to Colorado. So he was the creator of White Wall Sessions and done many amazing things in the state with video as well.
So he came in from self-exile.
Kind of. I don't know if it's a bad thing because we were talking about doing, you know, if we go ahead and do one more. Because at first we were like, after this one we'll talk, but we're kind of kicking around the idea of doing this again because we love this recording process so much. You're going to be out there all by yourself, you know, in this compound. You got your own room that's all set up for this.
Yeah.
We just send you music and you get that twang, write a song, and let's go back to the same studio and just see what happens again, because it was magic. The guy who recorded us is Ryan Rush. He is just amazing. We'd always wanted that, you know, like somebody that could actually capture what you sound like. And he just nailed it.
Yeah. Yeah. That space to create, but then also to come back and collaborate. It seems like everybody's looking for that. How do I find my own place where I can think?
Yes.
And then how do I find my place where I can play with people and make music with people? And what is that experience like? How did songwriting work on this? What was the process like of tossing things back and forth?
It was a lot. The last album, with the local support, we all kind of came in with our own stuff, like maybe something that hadn't worked in another group, and really pushed it that way. This time, it was really just kind of coming in and taking control of something when we were just kind of getting together. So you might have an idea, and it's kind of the idea, and that's the beginning of it. And then we really just would work it and work it, and then, you know, eventually it would come. So this whole album was kind of started with the end of the White Wall sessions. So when season 10 was happening, we wanted to get something out there, especially having Zugs in the group. Mm-hmm. So we wrote five. We wrote five songs, and we did them however we could. We learned them, and we did it. We did it together, and then we got the chance to play the Levitt again, which is always an honor to be at the Levitt. So we said, "Well, let's just work a few more songs." So we've got that set, and then we just kind of hit that point where I said, okay, this is the set list now. So every show we did in that next time, anybody who came to any of our shows that knows us, we played that same set over and over and over again with the thought process of we're going to go up here and we're just going to play it the exact same way we've been playing it and see what we can get done.
Yeah.
So all of the instrumental recordings and everything was just recorded in the 2 days. Everything on it is first time through. It was just worked that way, so that's how we could do it. So that's why I said we all wrote these songs, but we were kind of together through this whole process.
Yeah. So I hear everything on here from, you know, what sounds like a jam session, you know, to kind of kick this off, to some interaction with the band, to some things that I would say have a punk influence, others that I would say have a country influence. I don't know how you see it, but tell me a little bit about the different genres and areas of influence that you draw from.
Sure. It definitely is all the differences, and that's kind of the beauty of it. With Sean having his ska punk background, and then you had Carl, who's just so experimental and loves sound and everything, and then you got Jeff Zuger, who definitely brings that Americana vibe and, you know, just that twangy rock and roll. And then having Jason Bannock and myself, we'd, you know, been pounding this stuff out, sometimes just the two of us at shows to just fill some space or whatever. So having it all meld together the way how it did, I mean, it was so natural. That's what I mean. Sometimes I would have to sit back and, you know, I'd want to be really loud or abrasive, you know, because that's what I'm used to get a reaction. And you can hear Jeff's, you know, subtle twanginess of something, and it's like, no, that's the beauty of it right there. Yeah. The other part was we definitely didn't want to get into that, okay, so what genre are you?
Mm-hmm.
Especially around here, a lot of us, we get the chance to open for amazing bands. Through all these different people coming, that I think people get put in these traps. Like, we've got so much time to sound like something. If we sound like this, then we can always play with these bands when they come through town. That's Sioux Falls, South Dakota, for the most part, you know, if you're going to get paid something. And or you go and become a band that sounds exactly like the hits because that's what you're playing, which is, these are all fine and good things. But for us, it was like no weird, you know, gatekeeping of a certain sound or anything. I think music and art, you know, there can be irony, there can be everything involved in it. The minute you start taking it serious, it's great for a little while. But then, you know, if you go over the top with something or really push it too far, I mean, you're just becoming another one of those.
Yeah.
Or a caretaker of it, which is also, you know, I mean, like what Jeff Zuger did with the White Wall, actually taking things, recording them, putting them out, you know, and categorizing. But this, what we were doing was, Carl said, I've always wanted to do a crazy psychobilly song. Like, okay, well, what do you got? You know, like, I love surf rock sounds. So I mean, like, we can work this out. I love psychobilly too, you know, but this is you want to do something? Well, then what do you got? And then boom, you know, that came out of that. That would be the We All Go to Heaven.
Yeah.
I was heading south to 29. Just split from 90, and my ties were fired. Had a trunk full of money, and I spotted a cop.
That was fun. He got to get all of his angst on that sound out, and one of the ones that people tell me is a favorite. So
yeah
it was good.
I'm a big fan of Porcupine.
Porcupine,
it just hits.
Yes.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah. Like, oh, and some of that stuff was so, like, the, you know, the clapping.
Yeah.
you pay for how much you've grown. The other alligators don't like your style. Come and hang with the crocodiles.
At the time, I was like, yeah, cool, I'll throw it in. And then now you hear it, and it comes in like, oh wow. You know, that was perfect. You know, that was perfect that way. And we put all of our stuff out that we record. We're not afraid to show you a bad performance, too. So you can find it out there where it's like, you can see the early ones and the different speeds all through that time process. But yeah, Porcupine and that Sean Egan, that's that punk sound, you know?
Yeah.
And that bass, that overdrive in the bass, oh my goodness. Yeah.
This is one of my favorite things too, is I love the rehearsal. I love the process. I love watching things evolve. I like it when it gets messy, like you said, putting stuff out where it's not perfect and you can see it. I love that. And you like that too. There's value in the doing.
Well, you know, if I don't put myself out there and say that I exist, like I did for, you know, from like for, you know, what, 10, 20 years, not putting anything out and just not liking anything and waiting for this perfect, you know, thing. I don't live in that type of area. I want people to remember that I was here and that I was out here trying, and this is what I did. You find good, you find bad, and that's okay. You know, if you don't like it, that's okay. It was probably more just that I want it out there. So somebody can find it one day if they'd like to.
Yeah. Tell me about Do You Love Me as a song.
Do you even love me anymore? Do you think I am as small as before? Do you still think I'm pretty? Do you love me? Love is forever and lost can find love.
Okay, yeah. Do You Love Me is kind of an ode to my wife when I wrote that one. And it's one of those in any relationship where, you know, you kind of need that validation. And she definitely will not be afraid to, you know, just ask things. And it was just kind of just something for her that when I wrote it. But of course, the way how it came out and how it showed up is completely different. And I always like to kind of twist things, because if I just wrote, you know, a song saying that I love you to my wife, she would break it up and toss it out a window. She would say something and I would not say it on the radio.
I listened to that song and I thought, this is a song that has a story behind it.
Yeah.
And I love it. It's a beautiful song.
Thank you.
It's a beautiful song. It's beautiful songwriting. I love it. And yet it is not a simple, yeah.
And I love music that, you know, breaks apart from what it's doing.
Yeah.
I'm always paranoid that I'm a fake, you know, imposter syndrome. I'm, you know, not, I shouldn't be doing this. I'm wasting time. So that's the part of my songwriting that I like to, you know, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but I'm going to change it right here. This is different now. And yeah. I feel like it came across like that.
Yeah. Fake is one of the last words I would attach to you, my friend, by the way.
You.
Pick another song that you really like. What's one of your favorites to that has a story behind it that we can close with?
Sure. We've already talked about Each of Us, but Jeff Zucker did write a song on this album, which is Ruby.
My pretty baby, she got me on fire.
got me right down on my knees. Curly black hairline in the morning light. She does just what she pleases. My pretty baby, she got me on fire. From the first time that we met.
Okay, sure.
And Ruby is a very beautiful song, and he was he micromanaged the whole thing. I mean, down to if you watch the live performance on the Under Cinderblock Sharks for the White Wall sessions, I'm not singing it. He brought somebody in to sing, and he nailed it out of the park. But he was just so funny on the recording. He's like, I don't want it to be so, you know, out there. I want it to be kind of pulled back, you know, like he's just thinking. And it took so much to just go into this beautiful recording studio and just be so quiet and sing and, you know, meek to it almost. But it's a song that he wrote after his longtime love, his dog, Ruby, passed away, and he was inspired to write this song, and we worked it, and I think we nailed it, and we even got a little, if you listen to the end of the song, we kind of got a little build up right at the end, and he did not want any build up, but he still gave us the okay, that was fine.
It's
a beautiful song, and it's his first that I know of that he's got out and in the world, so.
Yeah.
And he's a good songwriter.
Yeah, I love that.
My pretty baby, she got me on fire. When she looks me in the eyes.
That's my friend David Saul, Pale Norse and the Cinderblock Sharks, available to stream now. Connect with the band on Facebook to find a CD. And if you are a local band or musician, we want to hear your music. Email me in the moment at sdpb.org to learn how. That is our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Ellen Kester and Ari Youngeman. Our executive producer is Kara Hetland. I'm Lori Walsh. From all of us at SDPB, thank you for listening.
Down in the morning time, I can't stand to be alone. She got me on fire. Ruby, baby, come back home. I miss your kisses down in the morning time. I can't stand.